Good morning and welcome to the East Tennessee Report, a public affairs program of the Journal Broadcast Group. My name is Frank Murphy. It's my favorite weekend of the year. Jefferson and Bass are in the house. Good morning, Dr. Bill Bass, John Jefferson.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Happy to have you here. The new book, The Boneyard, hit stores this past Tuesday. Welcome.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Same here.
Congratulations. Now, John, how many Body Farm novels is this now?
Because this is novel number six. I'm stunned.
Well, and congratulations. I know you've got a few more up your sleeve, right? Isn't the deal for
a few more somewhere up there?
Now, last time I've had opportunity to do a couple of things with Dr. Bass. Now that you've moved to Florida, and we'll get to that in just a couple moments. But Dr. Bass was indicating that at some point, and there's no definite date on this, at some point he maybe sees, you know, John Jefferson taking over the series of Brockton novels.
Maybe we'll see. That would be a different and lonelier experience. So let's hope that's not happening anytime real soon. Mm-hmm. But then also, you know, at some point I may spin off some other books on my own. So,
and what are your thoughts on that, Dr. Bass?
Oh, I'd like to see John get started on his own series. I kind of look at John as a graduate student. You know, you encourage graduate students to expand their knowledge and get to the stage where they can get off on their own. Mm-hmm. And I think John's at that stage. He's a great writer, and I don't think he needs Dr. Brockton to help him. He comes up with great characters.
I don't know if you happen to sneak a peek at my note card that I read the book last night, and I loved it as I've loved all of them. Two of the words I wrote to myself are spin and off. Okay. And I actually thought of this, wondering if – it's not an original idea, obviously. Something in the book, in the new book, The Boneyard, made me wonder, oh, I wonder if John and Dr. Bass are setting us up for a potential spinoff, because there's – in this particular book, Dr. Brockton, the character who's sort of a combination of the two of you but runs the Body Farm at UT.
Right.
Travels to Florida for 2 weeks and investigates two cases while he's down there with – a crew of well-defined characters who I thought these guys could eventually turn up in other books.
Ah, Grasshopper, you're very wise. Working on this book, actually, I did consciously think, okay, you know, these could be the beginnings of a series of Florida crime novels. Mm-hmm. These characters from the Florida Department of Law Enforcement.
Yeah, you get Cigar Chomp and Stu Vickery, you know, who is just really, you can picture him, everything about him, he's so well-written.
Oh, wow, cool. Well, thanks. Yeah, I did think that Stu Vickery, the FDLE agent,
and Angie St. Clair.
Angie St. Clair, the forensic tech, who is based on a friend of mine, actually. Not the sad parts of her story, but the sort of real and technical, you know, good at her job parts are based on a good friend of mine who works for FDLE. Mm-hmm. I did think, you know, these could be the characters who are the springboard to this Florida series.
Okay.
And I've done some initial research on a Florida crime novel.
That, oh, that'd be great.
That they would carry.
Yeah. Because now I'm reminded, I watch a lot of television. And when I'm reading the new Jefferson Bass book, I kind of thought, you know, this is kind of like one of those episodes. And they've done this on CSI, which I know is maybe the worst example to bring up when we're talking forensics. But Laverne and Shirley, we could bring up if you want. The show doesn't matter. But the concept is there's that one episode once in a while, you know, where Fonzie goes to Milwaukee and instead of hanging out with the Cunninghams, he's hanging out with Laverne and Shirley for an episode.
Right.
Or where Grissom goes to Miami and he's hanging out with the guy with the sunglasses on and off constantly, you know, for a whole episode. And next thing you know, they
right.
get a show.
There's that sunglasses guy, right?
Yeah.
Right, right.
And, you know,
so there's that cigar chomping investigator.
So
right.
I kind of had that, the good part of that feeling when I'm reading the new book, The Boneyard.
You didn't have the jump the shark, Fonzie jumps the shark feeling.
No.
Good.
No.
Yeah.
And in fact, the Schlemiel, the Schlemazel feeling.
Exactly. Yeah. And in fact, you know, I've started doing some research on, you know, what, you know, I think could be that first Florida based spinoff novel. Novel, which would deal with human trafficking, which is a huge, huge problem in Florida. I mean, it's a big problem throughout the country. And, you know, and I just, in fact, before we came over to the station, I had coffee with someone with the FBI locally, talking about that as a problem here. And, you know, it is a big trend and a big issue. And, you know, who better to deal with it than, you know, Angie St. Clair and Stu Vickery.
Is it especially in areas where you have people immigrating from other countries? Is that what kind of we're talking about? I mean, I can't imagine.
It's interesting. There are two big trends in human trafficking. One is immigrant trafficking, and the other is domestic minor sex trafficking. Sadly, runaway girls mostly who are really vulnerable to being picked up and exploited. And you know, those are very distinct, you know, sources and trends, but they're both a big problem.
In the new book, The Boneyard, Dr. Brockton travels to Florida, into the Tallahassee area, to the northern panhandle of Florida, much like John has done in real life.
Exactly. He goes for less happy reasons than I went. Mm-hmm. I moved to Florida because I met and fell in love with and married a wonderful woman in Tallahassee. Mm-hmm. Dr. Brockton was not so fortunate in his trip to Florida. He did not fall
he
in love.
He gets beaten in the process.
Yeah. He does not come out of it the better. He'll need a little rest and recuperation. But let me ask, though, one of the reasons that the books are so popular here in East Tennessee and Knoxville specifically is because of the local references. And we get a touch of that in the first couple of chapters. You know, you write about Neyland Stadium, as you do. But I'm obviously hopeful, and I'm rooting for more Knoxville, more Tennessee in future books.
Of course. There will always be Tennessee in the Body Farm novels. You know, but, you know, I mean, of course, just like Dr. Bill Bass in real life has gotten around quite a bit, Dr. Bill Brockton is, you know, going to get around a bit as well.
Yeah, now, in real life, I've done 4 or 5 cases in Florida and spent weeks down there if you added them all up.
Well, and you've worked in Iran and done work all over the place.
Yeah, worked in Australia.
Okay. Well, let me get to that in a moment because I also want to talk about your ancient history in South Dakota and how I learned a little bit about that this past January. But one thing I totally ripped off from NPR is to have the author read a few sentences from their book. This is something that I imagine you have to do differently in each of the novels. You have to come up with a way to explain to the newcomer what the Body Farm is. And this one just particularly touched me. I thought, oh, all right, this is good. I want John to read this sentence aloud as you describe to somebody who's opening the book for the first time what you do, what Dr. Bass has done now for how many years at the forensic research facility at UT? How many years has the Body Farm been around? Like 40?
40. It was started 40. In 1980.
Oh, okay. So we're talking about then 30 years.
30 years, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, at the current location, right.
At the current location, it did exist 9 years before that. It started in 1971. But the one that John and I write about really occurs in the area back of the UT Hospital, which starts in 1980.
Okay. All right. So let me ask you then to read this description. This is from the new book, The Boneyard, where the reader is introduced to the concept of what a body farm is.
And how far down do you want me to go?
Just the description, a couple of lines where you're describing, you know, what happens there.
The Body Farm was perched on a hillside high above the Tennessee River. Here, a mile downstream from the heart of Knoxville, more than 100 corpses in various states of disrepair were dispersed across the facility's 3 fenced-in acres. Most of the bodies lay above ground, though some were buried. And in a far corner of the facility, looking like eerie sentinels standing at attention, were 3 nude men, not standing, actually, but hanging, suspended by the neck from wooden scaffolds.
Wow. I don't know if you're paying somebody to do your audiobooks, but don't. Just do it yourself.
I would love to. I would kill to do the audiobook reading. I keep waiting for them to ask me.
Well, send them this. Well done.
All right.
Thank you. All right. And now would it be a lynching study that Dr. Brockton is conducting in this particular chapter of the book? Is that something that, based on a real anthropological study you did?
It's a master's thesis. Some questions on what's called encapsulation, in which as the noose tightens around the neck, as the body decays, it tightens down, and what you have in the circle or the noose part, you have some of the vertebrae from the neck, the cervical vertebrae. And I think that they are trying to determine how often either the first, second, third, or fourth gets caught in this thing, yeah.
So this would be a valuable research for suicides and for hate crimes.
That's right.
There's an interesting case that that I've heard you talk about, a case where some bones were found in the woods I think somewhere south of Knoxville. You know, nobody was sure how that body got out there, and you looked up at a tree branch.
Can you? That was just outside of the Bullwaters paper plant. They found in the woods that would be on the edge of the Hiawassee River. Some skull remains, and they called me to go down there, and they go, it's been there long enough for the leaf to have fallen on it and some of the plants to grow up. And so it's been there a while, but nobody could figure out how the individual got here. And because everybody's looking at the bones on the ground, and I just happened to look up in the tree, and here's a rope hanging down. And this guy had gone out there a couple of years before and hung himself. And what happened was eventually the body comes undone and mm-hmm. just falls down under the tree. And it had been there long enough.
Does anything stay up in the noose, the skull or anything?
No.
It all comes down.
No,
okay.
Yeah, it all comes down, yeah. And in this case, there wasn't anything encapsulated in the rope. But it had been there long enough for the tree to grow around the rope. So you could see that. It was just not there this one year, but it's been there at least a couple of years because the tree has grown up around the rope that was tied around the branch.
Is there such a thing as a forensic botanist then?
Yeah, there is. Oh, there is a forensic botanist, yes. There are two or three people that do that. And, you know, we call on them frequently. It's more in the terms of plants than it is the tree limbs and things like this, so.
Fantastic. We're talking with John Jefferson, Dr. Bill Bass. The new book is The Boneyard, and it is out now. It's out this week. And you guys are traveling all over the place, all over the Southeast. But this week you'll be back in East Tennessee for some signings in Farragut and in Athens, and then later on down in Maryville. We'll have the complete list for you. And also you can find it at the – can I call it a fan site? Bonezones.com.
Sure. Yeah.
Because you've got this group of dedicated former UT employees who really make your life easier at these book signing events.
They do that.
Okay.
And then there's also on our website, jeffersonbass.com, which
right.
talks a little bit about this book and the prior books. And there's a first chapter of this book is on there, posted on there. There's a link to the book tour schedule. And
that's updated by the publisher, so it's very
So people can go to jeffersonbass.com and learn a little bit about the book and also see where we're going to be over the next couple of weeks.
So we'll have the details for you where they'll be on Wednesday in Farragut and Turkey Creek, and then the following Wednesday in Maryville, and also Athens on St. Patrick's Day. So that'll be pretty awesome. We are talking about the book, talking about the Body Farm series of novels. And in this book, Dr. Brockton has something unique with Dr. Bass, something in common with Dr. Bass that goes back to some of your earliest days of forensic anthropology when you were excavating Indian or Native American bones. What year was that?
Well, it was from 1960 to 71. So,
because you couldn't get away with that nowadays.
No. Actually, it was from 56 to 71. It was 14 years I spent in the plains. This was something that was mandated by the laws. What you have is the Army Corps of Engineers building dams on the Missouri River, and part of the money for those dams went to the recovery of the prehistory of the area. Well, the prehistory of the area essentially were the three sedentary tribes that lived out there in the, say, 1700s, 1800s. This would be the Arikara, the Mandan, and the Hidatsa. Most people have never heard of the Arikara or the Hidatsa. The Mandan, most people know of because Lewis and Clark spent the winter with them in 1804 when they were going mm-hmm. west.
But Arikara, is that what you said?
Arikara,
because they factor into the new book, The Boneyard, where Dr. Brockton remembers excavating that tribe.
That's right.
I don't want to give away anything. I don't want to give away too much of the plot points of the new book because I know people are going to go out and read it. But I do want to talk about your history.
Well, this is more than just locating one burial. The villages or the houses that the Indians lived in were earth lodges. And when these collapsed, they leave a kind of a donut-shaped hole of depression on the ground. You can find them very easily by driving across the prairie. And you drive up, you go over the edge where the edge of the house was and down in through the house a little bit deeper and then up on the other side and out. So it kind of feels like you're driving across and going over a bunch of donuts. And these are easy to find. And the archaeologists were excavating a lot of those. But then the question came up, what were these people like? I mean, what is the biological characteristics of the Aricra? And none of that existed. So there was a push made to excavate as many of the burial areas as we could before all this goes underwater. And in the first year I went out in 1957, we excavated by hand. And, you know, we dug about 25 graves that year. And so you're not getting very fast. And the water's coming up, so you know where these burial areas are.
A lot of people in East Tennessee can relate to this concept of the dam being built and the water rising.
That's right. I mean, you get this is what happened to Norris and happened to all the ones on the main stream of the, of the Tennessee. But what we did was we decided we've got to figure out some way of doing this faster. So we started using heavy power equipment. I remember the first grant I wrote. I wrote a National Science Foundation grant in 1960 to see if we couldn't, use heavy power equipment. And, you know, I was kind of laughing stock. You know, they were teasing you about that. Well, they teased me about this. But it worked. From the time that the Indians left in the early 1800s until we are there now, it's been about 150 years. There's been about a foot of soil to blow in over the area. This is windblown soil blown away by the glaciers that came in. And this is called lerse or windblown soil. And you have to go through the upper foot before you get to the ground that was disturbed by the Indians. And so you just got to remove that upper mm-hmm. foot. Then you can get to anytime you dig in the ground, you can never put the dirt back as carefully as nature put it there originally. So if you know what to look for, then you can see this disturbance in the ground.
And that's surprising to me to realize that even after 100 years, 200 years, the earth of these graves didn't pack back in and look the same as the undisturbed earth next to it.
Well, it doesn't, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, it looks different.
When you are – if you think of the scraper running along – the blade is scraping off the dirt. When you reach a grave, the dirt that's put into the grave after you put the body in there is not as compact as nature put it there originally. Mm. So what happens is the grave, the dirt in the grave pulls away from the side of the pit. So you can pick up the pit line by looking at how the dirt pulls away from that. Now, the other thing you look at is when you dig a grave, you're putting the topsoil back into the subsoil.
Okay.
As you're covering it back, and you get a color change. So you're looking for color changes. You're looking for how the body pulls away, how the dirt pulls away from the edge of the pit and so forth. It's easy to find, really.
So I wasn't there in person, you know, back in 56. I was in diapers. but looking at the photographs that Bill has from those graves that were uncovered by the earth-moving equipment, it really looks a lot like a sort of circular patch of asphalt in an asphalt road. I mean, it's a little bit darker in the photographs, and it looks a little bit looser, you know, like a fresh patch of asphalt. I mean, just running through the roads in my neighborhood in Tallahassee, you know, I see these patches and I think, oh, yeah, that looks exactly – that's exactly the size and shape of an Aricra Indian grave. Yeah, you know, it makes me want to go out and dig it up, you know.
Well, listening to Dr. Bass describe this time back in South Dakota, I almost felt like we're a little bit of you, John Jefferson. This probably is the conversation – it's very similar to the conversation that you two would have had about a year ago as you're asking him – you know, interviewing him, questioning him about some of his past and some of the science that you can then incorporate into the new Body Farm novel.
Yeah, we actually – I mean, I had Bill give me this whole slideshow about excavating in South Dakota. We actually did the main piece of that back when we were working on the first book, Death's Acre, the nonfiction book about mm-hmm. Bill's career. And we spent a lot of time talking about South Dakota. And, you know, Bill showed me dozens of slides of the excavation in South Dakota. I think it would have been a really great, probably brutal, but really great to be on his crew out there, his crew of summer students, you know, working out there, you know, mm-hmm. you know, looking out for prairie rattlers and, you know, having contests, seeing who could throw dirt, clods of dirt out in the lake farthest with a shovel and, you know, that kind of stuff. That sounds like it was great.
All right. Now, let me reference a specific bone in the Dr. William Bass Forensic Anthropology Collection at Neyland Stadium. And this, Dr. Bass, you think, well, that's crazy. There's how many? There's thousands and thousands and thousands of bones under Neyland Stadium that you've got. But I think you'll know who I'm talking about when I say this. We did an event in January called Dinner with the Bone Doctor at Echo Bistro and Wine Bar. And it's a nice thing. People get to pay, money toward the new building that you guys are working on next to the body farm. They get a nice dinner out of it. And Dr. Bass puts on the horror show right as dinner is served, He waits until the salad is done. And then as soon as the servers have got all the nice, we're talking veal and bass, literally sea bass. The good, expensive food is on the table. And he comes out with the skulls and the femurs and the bones of the unfortunately smaller children he's bringing out this time. Well, there's this one you brought out, and it was the gnarliest, nastiest looking bone. And you're asking us to guess what happened to this bone. I think you must know the one I'm talking about.
The heel fractures.
Yes.
Yes.
All right. So I've said enough. This bone you showed us was probably how old? 200 years? 100 years?
Well, yeah, it's 200 years, I expect.
My goodness. All right. Well, describe that bone better. You can do it better than I can now, which was a femur that was broken and healed.
Yeah. Well, this is to show you how bone will heal itself. And this is an individual. Who
was it? One of the Ericra?
No, I don't. It was not an Ericra. This comes from a rock shelter in Billings, Montana.
Okay.
This was an Indian who I expect was kicked by a horse. If you look at populations in the plains area before the horse gets there, your fracture rate runs between 5 and about 7 or 8%. When the horse comes in, the fracture rate in the population increases to somewhere between 40% and 50%. It's like our teenagers driving cars. They have wrecks. Well, the young teenage boys in the Indian culture, they fell off the horses or got run over or something like that. This is an interesting one, though, because it is fractured twice. It's fractured up near the hip, and it's fractured down just about 6 inches above the knee. And normally a fracture that bad, it would cut the skin and the individual would die.
A compound fracture.
The compound fracture. In this case, however, it did not. The guy does not die. And I would suspect what happened is that the fracture did not break the skin so that the bacteria doesn't get into the break. And he's laid up for a while, and it heals. He's about 4 inches shorter on the right leg than he is on the left. I tell people here don't know much about South Dakota, but I tell people here he would make a great Indian in West Virginia because he'd walk around the hill. So just so long as he kept his right leg uphill all the time, he'd be all right.
I'm reminded now of a character in the new book, The Boneyard, who we find out at some point suffered an injury from the physical abuse at the reform school, and it must have affected his ability to walk and run and escape, perhaps, from his captors.
It's interesting. I was talking to Bill as I was thinking about these accounts that I've heard and read, some in writing, some from one of these survivors, a man who was savagely beaten at the real life reform school that inspired this story, just about how horrific these beatings were. And so I asked Dr. Bass, is there any way that these floggings with this heavy, heavy leather strap could leave skeletal marks, since the soft tissue is going to be gone from these old burials? And he said, well, if it inflicted trauma on the growth plate, of the pelvic girdle, the iliac crest, it could cause inflammation that would cause arthritic changes, in a teenage boy as he's, still in his growth phase, it could actually cause arthritis looking deformation of the bone.
We're talking with John Jefferson and Dr. Bill Bass about the new book, The Boneyard, which is now out. And in this book, and I've read all of them, obviously, and I try to keep throwing in these references to make sure you know that I did my homework.
We may have trouble remembering details from 3 or 4 or 5 books ago.
But I kind of got the feeling that I was picking up a little more. Maybe it's because I'm now having read more. I understand it better. But in this book, you just mentioned the bone formation or the osteology. And possibly it's because many of the bones that are uncovered in this book are people going through that growth phase, you know, these adolescents who are, end up dead. What is that?
That's the growth plate beginning to reacting to the response. That's what that is. But yes, I mean, you're...
Is that Dr. Bass's phone?
Yes.
I like the old-timey ring. All right. So I'm asking about the osteology in the new book. Yeah, I hear a lot of, the stuff about the growth. What is it what I'm trying to think of? In the femur, for example.
The growth plate. It's what's called a growth plate. What happens in the long bones, you have the shaft, and then in each end of the bone, you have the proximal end, which is closest to the head, and the distal end, which is furthest from the head. In between those three bones, you have cartilage. Cartilage is like your nose and your ear. And when you go through your circumpubertal spurt in growth, when you reach puberty and you grow about a foot or more in 1 year, and then you slow down and stop growing, what biologically happens there is that the epiphyses, or the ends of the bones—
That's the word I was trying to think of that I couldn't come to.
The epiphyses unite to the shaft. And that's when growth stops. Any damage to the bone at that stage is going to leave its mark on bone. I mean, you're going to be able to see that later on. The trauma, there is trauma to this area, and the healing effect is going to record that trauma to the bone. So, yeah, you...
And you also use the way to age, and by age, I mean determine the age of the skulls, because there's the various sutures and how far along they are, and you talk about the molars in the book. So it really is important, because you're narrowing down. In this particular storyline, you've got people of every age of development. You know, either they're going to be prepubescent, pubescent, or postpubescent, and you're trying to determine whose skull is whose.
That's correct. And at that age, you can do a pretty good – you can be pretty accurate in your estimation of the age at which they die.
We're talking about the Body Farm. We're talking with Dr. Bill Bass and with John Jefferson. All right. What are you thinking about for down the road for more Body Farm books? I mean, if you could write them fast enough, I would read one every month.
That'd be great. That'd be great. I wish I could write them that fast.
Yeah. But every year is good. Yeah. I'll still take it.
Yeah. Well, actually, we're talking about sending Dr. Brockton to France in the next one.
Okay.
There's some interesting old bones.
I need more Knoxville, though. Don't diss my Knoxville.
Okay. No. All right. So there'll be Knoxville. He'll take a quick trip to France from Knoxville. How's that?
Okay. And also for the people who have followed all the books along, there's been a story arc that mainly from Bones of Betrayal, the Oak Ridge book, and from The Bone Thief that is unresolved still. And sort of in the new book, The Boneyard, that story arc just kind of goes on pause.
Yeah. Well, the Boneyard, of course, as you know, happens over the course of about 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and it happens right on the heels of the prior book. So we're playing with the whole space-time continuum here, because, you know, the books come out one a year.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, the time interval that's covered in the last two books or the last three books is a space of only a few months. And so, you know, so this unresolved plot thread, you know, is there or is there not, you know, a baby in the works, you know, fathered by Dr. Brockton, we're still kind of hanging on that. You know?
And this is the part in the interview where Dr. Bass emphasizes that Brockton is more Jefferson and less Bass.
That's right. Yeah, totally. This is, you know, there's a lot of blurring between fact and fiction in these books, but this is total fiction.
Okay.
At least as far as we know.
As we know.
Okay. There is one thing that I haven't talked to John about, but for the next book.
Uh-oh.
Every interview, we have one of these, by the way, just so you know. If you go back and listen to the old ones, he always drops some bombshell on you at the end of every interview.
Well, we are in the process of building a new forensic anthropology building at the Body Farm right now. As a matter of fact, they're going to pour the concrete slab for the building this week. And
is Jimmy Hoffa going to be underneath it?
Well, that would be.
You really ought to put somebody in there just for grins.
For the fun of it? Okay. Well, there you go. People would think about that, wouldn't they?
Yeah.
But this is something that we may want to include in the next book. I mean, if we go off to some, you know, exotic place in France.
Because the Body Farm itself is a character in the books in a way.
And so we'll have to include the new building in the next book, because that would keep the Body Farm up to date.
All right. Well, our time has flown by, as it always has, and I appreciate very much your being here. The new book, The Boneyard, by Jefferson Bass, John Jefferson and Dr. Bill Bass. You can meet them coming up Wednesday at Kroger on Kingston Pike in Farragut, and that same day at the Borders, Turkey Creek. On Thursday, they'll be in Athens at the Athens Public Library, and then the following week, Dr. Bass will be at Hastings Bookstore in Maryville. You can find the details at jeffersonbass.com.
Thank you.
Gentlemen,
appreciate your being here as always. This is the East Tennessee Report, a public affairs program of the Journal Broadcast Group. My name is Frank Murphy. We'll talk to you again next Sunday.